so often we look at school spaces and we're looking at standardized, you know, test assessments, or we're looking at attendance data or survey results. And while that's all well and good, it very much is a lag measure in telling us how we're doing as an organization, right? So having that role of a coach to go in from a very proactive standpoint and note some of the different components that are playing out day to day in the classroom space that are having an effect both positively and perhaps detrimentally on our students' learning is so powerful. To then be able to bring that to a team space from a perspective-driven standpoint and say, hey, you know what? Like, I know we've been doing practice this way for this long, but this is what some of the data is starting to show us. Can we ask the tough questions of each other about whether that practice shifts moving forward?
I'm Jim Knight, co-founder of the Instructional Coaching Group, and you're listening to Coaching Conversations, where I talk with coaching experts from around the world so that all of us can learn better ways to make an unmistakably positive impact on the people around us.
Hello, listeners. It's ICG consultant Jessica Wise, and I want to invite you to join Jim Knight and the Instructional Coaching Group team at this year's Teaching, Learning, Coaching Conference in New Orleans. If you are looking to learn, practice, reflect, and grow your craft, the TLC conference is the place to be. Whether you join us in person or online, you'll experience meaningful keynotes, powerful breakouts, and time to network and invest in human connection with like-minded educators. Join us October 27th through the 29th as we gather to empower passionate educators to keep kids first. Visit instructionalcoaching.com/TLC-2024. I hope to see you there.
Allison, I'm thrilled. Learning is number one on the VS Strengths Finder. I work at the Center for Research on Learning, and I've lived by Eric Hoffer's line that in times of change, the learners inherit the earth, while the learned find themselves beautifully equipped for a world that no longer exists. So a book called Still Learning is like a book made for me. So I'm thrilled we get to talk through your new book. And so I wanted to start with a bit. Could you tell us all a little bit about your background and what you were doing before you started Still Learning? So,
absolutely, Jim. First of all, thank you so much for the invitation. It is truly an honor to be here and have an opportunity to talk together, not only about the book, but also about both of our work. So sincerely, thank you for that. My background is mixed in a good way. So I started as a teacher in urban schools in both Richmond, Virginia, as well as Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I moved into an instructional coach role and came to very much respect all of your work around coaching, not only in that role, but also as I later transitioned into the role of assistant principal, as well as director of teaching and learning. And much like you, always had this passion, not just for student learning, but for adult learning. And I felt as though there were just ways that we could do it better, right? We were talking about ways to differentiate and personalize for students at the same time that we were moving our adult learners into one size fits all, sit and get PD sessions. And that really became sort of a calling card for me to dig into some of the research around andragogy and think about what are the ways that we could design professional learning in our school systems better than we presently were. So with that in mind, my first book from ASCD came out in 2019, and that was focused on personalized professional learning, very much a guide for school and district leaders who valued that concept but weren't quite sure how to make that work in practice. And following that particular text, leaders came out sort of, I want to say, in two camps almost, right? Some folks said, yes, this is exactly what we needed. We want to learn how to better support our teacher leaders and our building leaders to be stronger facilitators. They might be amazing with students, but just aren't quite sure how to tap into that adult learner. And then I had other leaders that came forward very transparently and said, we believe what you've written here, but we don't yet have the learning culture to make it happen. Our teachers don't know themselves well enough. We don't have the team dynamics to build on this type of structure. Can you help us in that space? And that's very much where this new book, Still Learning, really came from, was kind of responding to that need in the field and making sure that leaders had what they needed to not only personalize leading, learning, but also develop some of those cultures.
Yes, it's very interesting to think about this. This is, and I think there's a lot of alignment between what you talk about, what we talk about. You mentioned five concepts in the book, so I thought I would go through each of the concepts and we can kind of go back and forth on them. But in talking about the five concepts, you talk about capacity building. And I'm wondering if you have any particular slant on what we mean by capacity building. I kind of get the idea, but I'm wondering how you would define that idea.
What's interesting about that particular term, Jim, very transparently, is that I feel as though it's evolved from the book's original inception, right? I think the outline for this first for this book was originally like conceived in November of 2019. And, you know, our learning spaces have changed and shifted so much since then for both our educators as well as our students. So I think at that time, it was focused more on the communication elements of capacity building. How do you bring, you know, your full self to the team, be a stronger communicator? But now, as we look ahead to challenges of burnout, of staff retention, of just even filling the seats in some of our classrooms, I think that need is even more urgent, not just around strengthening some of those communication norms and team building strategies, but also knowing ourselves as a learner, setting really intentional goals, both personally and professionally, that lead to a place of fulfillment rather than burnout. And with that, helping both leaders as well as teachers really understand where their time is going day to day so that they are as intently focused on the most important things as they potentially can be.
How easy do you find it to know yourself based on what you said, if you don't mind following up with that question?
Certainly. So that really digs into the first discipline of attunement. And one of the things that I think has been so ironic to me in this work is that the education field is looked to as a space of learning, right? Mm. Yet we're doing that self-reflection and that self-awareness work so much better in business spaces and other spaces than many times we are in the field of education. So it's not uncommon for someone in a business setting to complete a Clifton StrengthsFinder assessment or inventory and to have a conversation among their team about, these are my top five strengths. These are my five. Let's, you know, talk about how we build and grow on one another's work from a strengths-based perspective. And for whatever reason, even though we work with teachers on operating from a strengths-based perspective with their students, that self-awareness and an understanding of who they are in terms of their identity, their growth profile, and what motivates them is not as much top of mind in the education field as perhaps it is in other spaces.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because it's something I'm thinking a lot about right now. I think in many ways, we avoid learning ourselves. You know, we find things in the world that keep us busy and keep us from actually looking at, you know, what we're dealing with in the truest sense of knowing who we are. And because we don't know who we are, it's hard for us to really see into the hearts of other people and know them particularly well. At the surface level, I suppose there's, you know, we don't want to watch a video of our class because we don't actually want to see what happens, you know, if you're a teacher. But it's even deeper than that. I think aspects of things that are painful and loneliness and all those kinds of things that are, like, sometimes I've taken courses where there's a day retreat as a part of it. And some people are really nervous about that day where they don't do something because all the things you're doing, you know, the 10,000 things, they're keeping you from really knowing yourself. So that's what I was getting at, was how easy it is to reflect, to really deeply see. In, from your perspective, do you think people are able to do that hard reflective work? I guess they can, but it's just not easy.
That's absolutely right, Jim. And I think it really varies from person to person, right? So I've facilitated workshops focused on attunement where some individuals are able to look at an identity-driven reflection and dive right in to say, these components of my static identity definitely drive who I am as a professional, or these components of my dynamic identity have changed over time. I've also been in those same sessions where some individuals were struggling so much because it took them to a place where they had to sort of admit, I don't like who I am at home and I don't like who I am at work, and I'm not sure how to fix that, right? So You know, sometimes folks and systems will approach me and they'll say, you know, can you come in and do a keynote on this work? And, you know, I'll very transparently respond, I can do that as a starting point, but it's just a starting point. It's not going to be able to lead you and your staff to this space of deep reflection that's going to truly strengthen their capacity over time.
So then is attunement, like I'm tuned into myself and others? Excuse my sort of pinhead definition, but is that what it means?
Yeah, so definitely looking at, are you tuned into yourself? Do you know who you are from an identity standpoint? Do you know what motivates you? Do you understand how you grow? So you noted, you know, for yourself, that Clifton Strengths is learning, right? For me, my top one is significance, of really bringing something of meaning to the field. So being able to understand that and also capitalize on that. But then it also begs the question, once you know yourself, can you bring your full self to your school community? Is there some harmony there between who you know yourself to be and how you're able to present among your colleagues, among your students? Or are there some deeper community and cultural challenges that we need to perhaps address in order for that full sense of presence and belonging to really sort of manifest in that space?
That's fascinating. So the second concept is alignment. Tell me about what you mean by alignment and what it means for coaches. What do coaches need to know about alignment?
One of the things that I think coaches do exceptionally well in their work with the teachers that they're coaching is they set very clear goals, right? They're transparent. If they're doing their work well, they're transparent about a teacher's current strengths as well as their growth opportunities, and then articulately conveying how they are going to move forward in that practice together to see progress over time. And when we look at that discipline of alignment, it's really about that clear definition of goals. What is your purpose, both as a coach and as a teacher? And then does what you do day to day, your practice, align to that purpose? So often as educators, you know, we're driven by our inbox on a day-to-day basis rather than clear priorities that align to those goals. So being able to utilize our calendars, planners, task management systems in a way that not only helps us define what those goals are, but also ensures that day-to-day we're taking the most critical actions that are getting us closer to them. And that's personally as well as professionally. I think one of the big causes of burnout right now is that we might be setting professional goals, but we're not giving that same level of attention and definition to the personal goals and our personal needs that we have.
So the reason why I'm really interested in alignment, in addition to what you just said, is that it's the term used by Miller and Rolnick in motivational interviewing. And so what they say is when you conduct therapy from the motivational interviewing perspective, alignment is where the coach and or the therapist in that case and the person being therapized are in alignment. That is that the person who's receiving therapy has a goal they really want to achieve, and then the coach is helping them go after it. So the coach isn't giving the teacher, we use coaching, coach isn't giving the teacher the goal. The coach says, let's figure out the thing you most want to do, and then I'm going to help you go after it. And what I like about what you're saying is it sounds like I can do that more effectively if I have internal alignment in terms of what my purpose is and how my actions reflect my purpose, that there isn't a dividedness between the inside and the outside. There's wholeness there. Not to get too thick here.
No, not at all, Jim. And, you know, thinking about that, not just from a personal standpoint, but then also a coaching standpoint, you know, typically, you know, Michael Hyatt will say that we sort of operate within three different circles. There's that circle of doing, and that's vocationally sort of what drives us. There's the circle of relating, how we're engaged socially with a partner or with our family or our friends or our colleagues. And then the circle of being, how we're sort of self-grounded in the things that are important to us, whether that be health-related or time for spirituality or for pause. And what I often find when I work with educators is that oftentimes they're setting goals in one of those three circles rather than all three. So they might be very firmly focused on that circle of doing, but they feel burnt out because they haven't thought about how their actions or their, you know, sort of reactions with others are driving their work.
Hi, everyone. It's Jessica Wise, host of the Coaching Questions on the Coaching Conversations podcast with Jim Knight. I am very fortunate to be part of an amazing consultant team here at the Instructional Coaching Group. If you are wondering about how to implement, reset, or recharge instructional coaching in your system, partnering with one of the consultants is the way to go. contact our managers of partnership and outreach for the opportunity for your district or school to build and sustain your effective instructional coaching program. These awesome consultants tailor learning to your needs as they work with coaches and administrators to ensure high-quality learning geared toward long-term and life-giving implementation. Visit instructionalcoaching.com and click on Bring ICG to Your District to request a complimentary consultation.
And similarly, you know, your yoga session or that walk in the morning might be the first thing to sort of get kicked off when you're not, you know, meeting all of the time deadlines that you have. So being able to be in that place of alignment, not only with your own goals, but then also to be able to transparently share that with your colleagues, whether that's a coach or a supervisor, so that they're able to support you in that. Some of the strongest school communities with whom I've worked are spaces where individuals are comfortable sharing not just the professional goals, but the personal ones as well. To be able to say, you know what, you committed to this. Like, how are you holding yourself to that standard for our students, but then also for your family, for your children, for, you know, the other people in your life that are important for you to do this term, this work, not just in the short term, but the long term.
Right, right. And so psychological safety is a really important part of that.
Absolutely.
You're not going to bury your soul to Debbie Downer. You know, you have to create a safe place. Next concept is perspective. Obviously, really important for coaching and really important for learning. I'd love to hear your take on perspective.
Certainly. So when we look at some of the research on perspective, typically what individuals will say is it requires some type of disorienting experience to change one's perspective or to shift one's schema. So that's why, quite honestly, we'll hear people say, you know, after a significant life event or perhaps a tragedy or a major change in their life, you know, that really shifted my perspective. And I think one of the universal changes we've all seen was, you know, sort of post-pandemic, how that has shifted our perspective as educators and the environment within which we work. But the real challenge here is how do we create a safe space for individuals to share their perspectives, whether they might be aligned or, you know, sort of misaligned or differing from each other in a way that, as you noted, feels safe, right? It's coming from that, that place of psychological safety, but also asks the bigger questions in the field. So to be able to say, you know what, hey, I've been looking at this classroom data and I'm wondering what if we made this shift in our grading policy, or what if this were one of the strategies that was truly driving our, you know, English language arts curriculum? Those sometimes are harder questions for teachers to pose, both to one another as well as to a coach, unless they're willing to engage sort of in that place of vulnerability and trust, where they can ask the tough questions among each other and then use the data as a team to guide the decisions that they make moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so much packed in that. So the first thought I had was that the coach needs to be aware of their perspective and then interact in a way that makes space for the other person's perspective. And then the other part of it is, when you brought up data, is I think what data can do is broaden your perspective. As Laura Lipton and Wellman said, you know, data makes the invisible visible. You can see more depending on the interpretive frame you bring to it. So if I'm looking for how many different students are answering questions and what kind of answers they're giving, that's going to make me see different things in the class. And if I'm just watching, I'm going to have a zoned in perspective. But I think the coaches, I guess also if we use that concept of perspective, they're helping people expand their perspective, maybe beyond implicit bias, for example, and to see other things. So that it's a really core concept for coaching, I think.
And one of the things that I value so much about that coaching role is that those individuals collect so much data in our school spaces that's often overlooked, but is truly the type of data that we need to be able to enhance educator practice and also improve student learning. So often we look at school spaces and we're looking at standardized, you know, test assessments, or we're looking at attendance data or survey results. And while that's all well and good, it very much is a lag measure in telling us how we're doing as an organization, right? So having that role of a coach to go in from a very proactive standpoint and note some of the different components that are playing out day to day in the classroom space that are having an effect both positively and perhaps detrimentally on our students' learning is so powerful to then be able to bring that to a team space from a perspective-driven standpoint and say, hey, you know what? Like, I know we've been doing practice this way for this long, but this is what some of the data is starting to show us. Can we ask the tough questions of each other about whether that practice shifts moving forward?
Yeah, I always say that to use standardized test scores as your goal for coaching, it's kind of like a GPS that only tells you when you've arrived. You really need to be able to measure it week by week, you know, and know, are we on? And usually the first things you try don't work that well. You have to make adjustments, make adaptations along the way. Now, the next one is a word I hear frequently, collective efficacy. So I first heard about it from a friend of mine, Megan DeShannon Moran, and then came up a lot in Hattie's work as a really high effect size. So I'm curious to hear your take on a collective efficacy. We might explore this one a little bit.
Huge amount of respect for John Hattie's work, as well as Jenny Donahue and Stephanie Height and the work that they've done in this space. It was really important to me as I looked at the five disciplines to not just look at the individual level, right? So not just look at attunement and alignment and what we could be doing as individual learners, but also through perspective and collective efficacy to begin thinking about what that means at the team level. So if we're setting individual goals, that certainly drives us from a place of self-efficacy. And the example that I often use in workshops and really seems to resonate with folks is to kind of go back to Pizza Hut's Book It program from years ago, right? Sort of that driver for middle school kids. If you read so many books, you get the stars on the chart, and then it translates to a personal pan pizza, right? You're able to see that progress over time. But one of the things that I think we overlook in school communities is the importance of translating that self-efficacy to the team space. To being able to say, okay, those were our goals as individuals, but what are the team-based goals that we truly need in order to move our work forward? And how do we operate not just from a place of individual vulnerability, but shared vulnerability to admit we don't know what we don't know, and this is an area where we might need to be stronger, but if this is truly our goal as a team, let's figure it out together and let's continue to work forward. Some of the schools that I've seen see the most amount of progress. Yes, they have clearly defined goals, but they also have really structured mechanisms and schedules that sort of drive those goals forward. So they're not apologetic about the fact that this is something that's important to all of us and it's going to drive our decision making. And with that in mind, they make sure that their team schedules, their agendas, their structures, their protocols all line up to that from a place of collective efficacy to make sure that they're purposefully leveraging that time as well as they possibly can to drive those goals forward.
Yeah, we have a concept called freedom within form. You need structure, but the structure has to be adaptive. And so the impact cycle, for example, is an example of freedom within form. We have a process we're going to follow. But I want to go a little deeper into the efficacy and see if I've got it. Since I've got you here, I'm going to learn from you. So let's take efficacy in a sports environment. Okay. And let's say we have a basketball team. And the one of the players on the team, if he or she, depending on the team, has self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. They're like, it's my turn to take the, you know, when it's time to win the game, give me the ball. I'm going to be the one to shoot the shot. I can win. And when they enter into the whatever the game is, the dynamics, they come from a place of maybe confidence, they're solid in who they are. That to me is self-efficacy. And now self-efficacy has other elements to it. It might relate to your relationships to other people, clarity around your purpose, but I know who I am, and positive self-efficacy means I feel in the circumstance I can succeed, you know, whatever the circumstance might be. So collective efficacy would be where the whole team is on a winning streak. And they say, you're like, I don't care who we play, we are going to win this game. And they have this sense we're all together. We're together. Where I'm not about me. I'm about what we can do collectively. I want to support my colleagues. And we're doing amazing good things here together. That to me is collective efficacy. So do I have it right? Is that your take on the difference between what we mean by collective efficacy?
That very much resonates with my work as well, Jim, where it's not just about who carries the ball, it's about where we end up together as a team, right? So thinking about, are we leveraging some of the things from different perspective taking standpoints to say, you know what, hey, that strategy you recommended, that actually got better results than the one that I'd been using. Like, let's run with that. Or being able to say, you know what, I made these commitments to our team last week and I missed the mark. Can you help me as a thought partner and as an accountability partner to make sure that not only am I meeting this week's mark, but I'm doubling that moving forward, so that there becomes this sense of trust, but also commitment to one another in the work. And I had this conversation with another educator just earlier this week around, you know, the topic of commitment, and are some of our newer educators as committed as perhaps, you know, educators who were entering the field years ago? And I think one of the responsibilities that we have as leaders, as well as instructional coaches, is to set very clear goals for our teams and the folks that we're working with, and also to build that trust towards those goals. So when we look at trust specifically, it typically is that juxtaposition between strength. Are we seeing progress as a team over time, but also vulnerability? Are we honest about the areas where we need to continue to improve? And my hope is that a lot of this work continues to be goal-driven, but also gets really honest in that vulnerable space to say, you know what, these practices served us really well 20 years ago. They were great practices then. We don't second guess anything that we did, but they might not be the best right now, right? Let's find sort of what that better practice is for where our students are now and where our educators are now.
Collective efficacy isn't about being nice. The collective efficacy is about coming together in confidence with each other and succeeding. So if you think of kids putting on a play and the play just rocks the house and it's a really big success, how positive the kids feel in that moment, they have collective efficacy. Now, collective efficacy doesn't have to be something in a moment. It can be something that builds over time. And probably what builds collective efficacy is success. You know, I think, in fact, being nice could be hinder collective efficacy because we don't talk about the things that need to be discussed. Which isn't to say you should be a jerk either. You know, you want to be respectful and you want to find ways to have empathy towards others and see deeply into them and communicate in ways that are affirmative, or what Liz Wiseman called a multiplier. But it's really, collective efficacy is really about coming together as a team and believing we can do it. Am I off track, or is that what it is?
That is. And it's, you know, looking at that idea of, you know, it's not necessarily about playing nice, but playing respectfully. So, you know, a couple of the different examples that I give in the book are the ways in which some of our armed forces do after action reviews, right, where they're just incredibly transparent to say, hey, this worked well, this didn't. Or, you know, Pixar has an incredibly powerful brain trust where they bring individuals from across their organizations to give transparent feedback on particular scripts as well as content development. And when I look at collective efficacy specifically, for me, it's not necessarily about the position, but the positioning together. So how are we going back to that discipline of attunement, knowing ourselves to say, this is your strength, this is yours, this is mine, and then positioning all of that together in a way that moves us collectively as a team towards that overall goal that we've established. Sometimes, you know, that's nice. Sometimes it means we've got to ask some tough questions along the way.
Well, it has to be psychologically safe. So I'm not saying be jerks, but I think, I think you can have respectful, you know, it's safety and accountability for change. Those two things together is would be the key thing. Well, I better move on to the next one, but I like all this. But, you know, if you carry the ball in basketball, you're going to get a traveling call, so you can't really carry the ball. But anyway, organizational learning is the last of the concepts. I actually wrote an article when I was just starting as a doc student called Do Schools Have Learning Disabilities? And I was hugely influenced by Peter Senge and then all the people that worked after him. So to me, this is right in my wheelhouse too. So tell me about organizational learning and what that means. It obviously overlaps. Maybe it brings together all the other concepts, but what are your thoughts about it?
Certainly. So it very much brings together the different concepts and was, much like you, inspired by Peter Senge's work, right? So looking at those concepts of team learning and mental models and personal mastery and thinking about from a systemic level within our schools what that means. And for me, I'll admit this chapter was somewhat aspirational because I don't know if we're there yet in our educational spaces. Mm-hmm. So I referenced earlier when we were talking about alignment, some of the ways in which, you know, the business spaces might be, you know, leveraging some of those tools a little bit better than we are. And one of my hopes for our collective profession is that we become models of learning, not just for our students, but for the broader sort of global environment as a whole, so that we're looking to our school systems as ultimate models of learning, as learning mm-hmm. ecosystems, so that when we're developing training as a corporation, or we're looking to really grow individuals within a nonprofit organization, we're not necessarily looking outward to consultants and other people in the corporate space to do that, but instead, we've developed our schools in such a way that they are integral models of learning for our students, but also adults, and that we can look to them at a variety of different levels to guide some of that work. So whether it be around developing individuals or teams or the whole system from a structural standpoint. And one of the terms that really stuck with me as I was going about this work comes from Keegan and Lascal Leahy's work around deliberately developmental organizations. Mm-hmm. That term just continues to stick with me because it's almost like a call to action to say, right, like, how are you not, you know, only this building with four walls that supports student learning, but what are you doing day to day as a leader and as a coach to be deliberately developmental for mm-hmm. yourself, for the individuals that you're coaching, and for the system as a whole? So this concept of organizational learning for me is about the individual components, but then also systemically how we're developing in our schools in a way to be true learning ecosystems for the field as well as beyond.
Yeah, I use the term learning architecture, but I think ecosystem's a similar kind of concept. And what we feel is there should be connection between everybody in the system. And so if a teacher over here teaches this part of the curriculum in a particularly effective way, and they learn something from the students, they have a coach they can go to, or the coach is going to learn, and then that coach is connected to all the other coaches and all the administrators. And so, you know, within a few hours, everybody in the system knows about this cool idea. And if you have coaches and administrators and a director of coaching, maybe champions for the coaches, if you have a system where everything's connected, then that learning should happen immediately. And I love your idea that if you want to learn about learning, go to a school. That sounds like pretty sensible to me.
It's been interesting to me, Jim, you know, that we certainly do well with schools in solving technical problems, right? We had to deal with COVID. We got folks on Zoom. We got devices in their hands. We have, you know, challenges around staff shortages. We get coverages. Like, those are technical problems, and leaders and coaches are incredibly adept in that. I think some of our best leaders are also really good at responding to adaptive challenges. So there are new, you know, things that emerge in learning. We might respond to something that we're seeing in benchmark data or in formative assessment data that we're collecting. And we use that as an opportunity for learning to adapt perhaps the way that we're shifting things. I think sort of the untapped space, if you will, are some of the generative opportunities that lie before us in education right now. We are bringing in a much different workforce than we have previously. A lot of our newer teachers coming into the field, this is not their first position, but instead they bring with them a wealth of vocational knowledge as well as field knowledge and executive functioning skills in a way that, quite honestly, a lot of our new teacher induction programs are not equipped to respond to, or there's perhaps a misalignment there in valuing some of that energy and expertise. We also have learned so much in the virtual space over the course of the past 5 years that I don't know that we're fully leveraging, both in terms of student learning as well as adult learning. So how could we be doing this better from a coaching perspective to use some of those tools for more frequent engagements with the teachers that we're coaching, or how do we use them as a space to collaborate more frequently than perhaps we might otherwise have an opportunity to do in team or in one-on-one meetings? So my hope looking forward is that we truly use some of these generative opportunities that are starting to, as well as continue to emerge within the education space, and don't waste them, but instead ask those tough questions about, you know, could education look this way, or could our learning and professional learning spaces look that way? I think it's going to be a really important part of the work moving forward.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. I've got two more questions. One that I'm sure you've asked all the time. Why still learning? Why is that the title?
This was perhaps one of my favorite pieces to pull together when drafting the book, Jim. So quite honestly, we went through a bunch of different titles. I hated all of them. And I know as an author yourself, you've probably, you know, been through that experience where you're like, no, that's just not quite it. And, you know, I brought together a group of thought partners and colleagues that I truly value in my network. And I said, you know, this is the work that I'm trying to convey. And these are the key concepts that are so important. And together, you know, we sort of finally landed and pitched the editors, and they agreed on this sort of title of still learning, because it was really important to me that two things emerge in our responsibility as educators. One is that we're constant learners, that we don't just rely on the practices that led us through our teacher preparation programs, or that we're getting through our professional learning sessions, but that we continue to push one another's practice through the thoughtful questions and the coaching sessions and the different resources and conversations that we're leveraging along the way. So when our students look to us, they look to us not just as sort of fonts of knowledge and content, but also to true model learners who aren't afraid to sort of push their own boundaries, or as Jennifer Abrams would say, kind of stretch their learning edges, right? But then it was also really important to me that we understand, accept, and elevate the importance of stillness within the field. That we constantly glorify the ever-going hamster wheel of busyness and multitasking and constant shifting of responsibilities, or sort of adding to the plate of tasks, without really respecting and honoring the value and intentionality that's needed to pause, to reflect, and to make sure that we're making the most thoughtful decisions on behalf of one another, as well as our students. So, you know, one of the things that I think has been most powerful for me in this work, I had a superintendent come up to me after one of my workshops, and he said, "Thank you so much. You are one of the first individuals after 20 years in this field who has sort of given me permission, if you will, to add space and an appointment for reflection on my calendar." And I know how important that is, but I just didn't have the value and sort of the verification that that was something that was worthwhile until we had this conversation. And it's interesting to me, because in our conversations with students, we value reflection. We talk about reflecting on your work, seeing how you've progressed as a learner. And I don't know that we have that same value and that space for stillness and calm among our educators that we do for students.
Okay. Last question. Have you got a couple thoughts you'd like to wrap it up with? But I love the cover too, by the way. It's a beautiful cover. A few thoughts you'd like to leave us with respect to your book, things we haven't discussed, or maybe just big ideas, like, let's really emphasize this one or two things.
So speaking of the cover, Jim, I would actually love to leave off with that point. And this is the first time this has come up in a podcast interview, so I'm super excited to share it. I wanted to make sure that the cover included some type of image related to growth, right? That we were continuing to learn. But I also wanted to convey that it's okay over time to let go of practices that aren't serving us well. So for those of you who may not be familiar with the cover, I've kind of got one on the back wall here, but it has a variety of different dandelion designs in different colors. The whole idea of personalized professional learning is really important to me. And I wanted to make sure that in that work, individuals felt comfortable standing strong and continuing to grow, but also letting go of practices that weren't serving them well, and recognizing that they can share those practices with others and they still have value, even if they're not in their own present space.
Anything else you'd like to say for big, like sort of big ideas?
I would love to really encourage teachers, coaches, and leaders to make space for constant learning, for difficult questions, but perhaps most importantly, that reflection in your work, that when you're engaged in those coaching conversations, as well as your team meetings, you don't always need to be committed to that space of busyness, but instead you should feel very comfortable stepping back, looking at the data, asking questions of one another to make sure that the work that we continue to engage in on behalf of our students is as thoughtful and intentional as possible.
Well, I love it. I'm so grateful for a book that promotes what I think stands at the heart of a fulfilling life, which is learning. And yours is about learning people and learning organizations. So it's doubly powerful. So I'm very grateful. I hope this is the first of many, many conversations, Allison. Thank you so much for sharing your ideas.
Thank you, Jim. I truly appreciate the invitation, and I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to continue collaborating together.
Great.